Roma.
From my side.
Okay. Now let me welcome all the members who have joined us today. The workshop itself was supposed to have taken place last year with an agreement with UCT that they were going to take us through a number of these pieces of legislation. But for whatever reason, pressures in the institution, they could not do it. But we could not abandon that because it's very critical, especially that there might be members who are new in this field. And as legislators, know the laws. And so that when they get implemented, if we see gaps, we are able to recommend whatever amendments. But critically, when we do oversight, the law is the primary tool that we should use because the executive are executing the laws and policies. So critically, it is very important for members of parliament, for all of us, including the department, when we do oversight, they are the ones who should know that the laws are supposed to be implemented and implemented properly. And we are the ones who should be asking with authority what is going on. And that authority derives from policies and legislation. So that is why this workshop is very important. Equally, we have to ask any questions as we were doing our work. We were not able to say we are out of order because we knew that we have not gone through what we are supposed to do. So that is very critical. And I hope members are going to use this opportunity of the 3 days to make sure that we understand the policies and pieces of legislation that govern this area that we are called upon to oversight. Otherwise, I will hand over to the officials to do the work. I'm also a student, part of this. I should not pretend to know anything. Over to you, facilitators. I don't know how you have organized yourselves. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. It's Hisham Abada. I'm the Acting Director General for the Department Chair. Chair, we're going to, in terms of the agenda, have the presentation on a specific piece of legislation. In this instance, we're going to start with the National Environmental Management Act. And the officials will take the committee through the legislation. We will then subsequently have a session for questions and answers, and then we'll move on through the rest of the legislation. So we'll start with the National Environmental Management Act, and then we'll follow up with the Biodiversity Act, and that's how we'll deal with the items on the agenda this morning, if that's okay with you, Chair. Chair, I'm going to hand over to Ms. Amanda van Rienen, who's going to take us through the presentation regarding the National Environmental Management Act, Chair. And then if there are any questions, we'll deal with them subsequent to the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, Acting DG and colleagues. I will ask, I'm not sure who is in charge of the slide that is being presented, but I will just ask that it moves on as I progress through the presentation. Thank you very much for this opportunity. Next slide, please. As Acting DG has indicated, this presentation will focus very briefly on some of the areas contained in the National Environmental Management Act. We will briefly explain how this fits into the context of the Constitution, and then there are certain focus areas that we will be talking to specifically environmental planning, environmental impact management, integrated environmental management, the One Environmental System, and financial provisioning. Next slide, please. This is just a list of some of the acronyms that we may use in the slides, but it's really just for reference purposes. I'm not going to spend time on this. Please, next slide. So looking at the National Environmental Management Act and the specific Environmental Management Act, or CEMAs as we refer to them generally, how they fit into the Constitution is, of course, the Constitution is the supreme law of the country. It contains the Bill of Rights with a number of rights, including the environmental right contained in Section 24. It deals with the limitation of rights, the separation of powers between the legislative, judicial, and executive components. It specifically deals with the functional areas and competencies as contained in Schedule 4 and 5, and then there are a number of cooperative governance principles contained in the Constitution. It's the supreme law of the country, and any law or conduct that is inconsistent with it is invalid, and the obligations imposed by it must be fulfilled. So NEMA and all of the specific Environmental Management Acts, as well as the subordinate legislation, needs to fit into this broad framework, and the Constitution also requires that every piece of conduct that is undertaken by government and government entities must be consistent with the rules laid down by the Constitution. Next slide, please. The Bill of Rights applies to all law. It binds the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary, as well as all the organs of state. It applies between all organs of state, and it applies between the state and the people that it serves. Next slide, please. This is just a brief summary of all the rights that are contained in the Bill of Rights, and I've just highlighted the environmental one. You can see there's quite a lot of them listed there, but the environment one is specifically mentioned, and that is where the legislative mandate comes from and stems from. Thank you. Next slide. So just in short, to refresh our memories, Section 24 of the Constitution says everyone has a right to an environment that's not harmful to health or well-being, and to have the environment protected for the benefit of present and future generations through reasonable legislative and other measures that all have certain purposes in order to prevent pollution and ecological degradation, promote conservation, and secure ecologically sustainable development and use of natural resources while promoting justifiable economic and social development. This is an anthropocentric written term and clause contained in the Constitution. It's not necessarily the environment itself that gains from it, but the rights are vested in individuals, and it's a human right, so all persons have the right for an environment to be protected for their own purposes. NEMA and how this fits in creates the legal framework that links directly back to this environmental right as contained in Section 24 of the Constitution, and it attempts to create proactive and reactive interventions and management measures to comply with that and to give effect to that environmental right. It does a certain amount of key aspects. It confirms that the state is the trustee of the environment on behalf of all of the inhabitants of that environment. It sets out the fundamental principles that apply to environmental decision-making, especially to avoid negative impacts on the environment and to manage, minimize, and mitigate any impacts on the environment to within acceptable levels. It also specifically provides for compliance and enforcement of the provisions of NEMA and the specific Environmental Management Act, and it introduces a general duty of care to prevent, control, and rehabilitate the effect of significant pollution and environmental degradation. It also replaces the EIA regime that was present under the Environment Conservation Act some years ago. This is just a snapshot of the history of the Act. It was promulgated as far ago as 1998, came into effect early 1999. It's been amended a number of times, and as you will know very well, we are in another NEMA amendment process currently at the moment, so there's likely to be an 11th one added next year. This is just to give you an overview of where NEMA fits in and all of the specific environmental management acts underneath it, or as part of the environmental management framework. It deals with waste, air quality, protected areas, biodiversity, coastal management. I mean, of course, there are certain provisions of the Environment Conservation Act that are still relevant. The Water Act has also been added as a specific Environmental Management Act, and the World Heritage Convention Act is also another one that is not featuring on this slide. You will see that under NEMA, amongst others, there are environmental impact assessment regulations that form part of the subordinate legislation promulgated under NEMA. But each of these specific environmental management acts also have subordinate legislation issued under it, which is either regulation, standards, or notices, or a variety of these. So turning to the focus areas, the first one being environmental planning. Chapter 3 of NEMA requires the compilation of environmental implementation plans and environmental management plans by different national departments that are set out in the schedules to the Act. When they prepare these different plans, they must consider any other plans and aim for consistency among the plans. The purpose of this is to coordinate and harmonize all environmental policies, plans, programs, and decisions of the various national departments. And the aim is also to minimize duplication and secure the protection of the environment across the country as a whole, and also to give effect to cooperative governance principles that are set out in the Constitution. So these plans should identify any policies, plans, and programs by these national departments that may significantly affect the environment. So we can ask, all right, this is all good and well, but what does this mean? It means that every organ of state must exercise every function it may have or that has been assigned or delegated to it, and that may significantly affect the protection of the environment substantially in accordance with these plans, whether it's an implementation plan, a management plan, or a combined one, as they were prepared, submitted, and adopted by that specific organ of state. I just listed some of the departments that are affected by this, and you will see it's quite a big scope that is covered there. And then, in addition, some of the more recent developments was the Spatial Planning and Land Use Management Act that was introduced and that is being implemented in stages, as we know currently. But also it's a very important piece of legislation as far as environmental planning is concerned, because it has the ability for land use planning and environmental considerations to be merged and consolidated to a large extent. Next slide, please. Turning to Chapter 5 of NEMA, which deals with Integrated Environmental Management Act, the purpose of the chapter is to promote the application of appropriate environmental management tools in order to ensure integrated environmental management of activities. In order to promote or facilitate integrated environmentally sustainable and sound management, the Minister may provide for a range of instruments which should at least integrate environmental considerations into decision making. The potential consequences for or impacts on the environment of listed or specified activities must be considered, investigated, assessed, and reported on. And this is what we generally refer to as the environmental authorization regime. These activities generally require environmental authorization, and the detail of this has been unpacked in the various sets of environmental impact assessment regulations that have been developed over time, the latest and current one being the 2014 one. So it deals with authorizations being required for these activities prior to their commencement, and it deals specifically with impact assessment, but the chapter also deals with a range of environmental management instruments that is wider than just EIA. If we look at Section 24(2)(a) and (b) of NEMA, it gives the Minister and the MEC in concurrence with the Minister the power to identify activities that may only commence with environmental authorization, and it provides the power to identify geographical areas within which certain specified activities may only commence once they have environmental authorization. Linked with this power is the power to make regulations that is contained in Section 24(5). And this is specifically relevant in this case as far as the process and applications for environmental authorization is concerned. The detail of identifying the activities that may result in substantial negative impacts on the environment is contained in the EIA regulations in the form of listing notices. And the regulations require that an EIA process be followed for these activities. and that applications for environmental authorization be submitted to the competent authority for consideration for these activities before they can commence legally. This EIA process normally includes specialist work. It always requires some form of consultation, and there's some minimum requirements set for that. It requires investigation of the impact, and then obviously it results in decision making. So in order to prevent substantial detrimental impact, the minister may identify the activities that are subject to EIA prior to its commencement. And the activity's ability to impact on the environment is determined by, amongst others, the nature of the activity itself, the extent thereof, but also very importantly, the nature of the receiving environment or the location where it is proposed to be undertaken. And together with all of the specialist work and the investigation, there's also an environmental management program that's required that deals specifically with mitigation as are required and identified for measures that would be required during construction, through the operation, and up until closure of the development activity. Just a snapshot of what the EIA process entails. Obviously, it requires the assessment of the different environmental impacts that may occur. It includes an assessment of risks and the nature, significant consequence, extent, duration, and probability of all of these impacts occurring. It may include an identification of no-go areas, in other words, areas to be avoided because the impacts cannot be avoided there or cannot be mitigated. And in essence, it also attempts to avoid impacts. Only where impacts cannot be avoided, it needs to be mitigated. And the question that also needs to be answered as part of this process is, can these impacts be reversed or not? Next slide, please. It also includes the identification of alternatives, and this could be alternatives to the development proposal, but more likely an alternative to the location or the technology or the further more detailed interventions that are proposed as part of the development. And from a socioeconomic perspective, it also deals with the need and desirability of the proposed development in the location context. And in the end, it needs to make a call about the sustainability of the development. And all of these considerations should enable the competent authority to conclude an informed decision on this application for the proposed development. This is really just a snapshot of the two processes that are provided for in regulation. This one is the basic assessment. I think we can just move on to the next slide, which shows the scoping and EIA process. This one, I'm not going to try and attempt to go into detail with this, but it means that there's a consultation or an application rather. There's always the ability to do a lot of work and consultation and meet with the competent authority before the lodging of the application. In this process, there is a scoping part of the process or component, which means that the proposed development is unpacked as far as its scope is concerned. There's consultation on that. There's a scoping report submitted, which indicates the level of assessment that would be required going further into the process. The competent authority has the ability to refuse the application then and there on submission of the scoping report only in limited instances. In most cases, applications do progress further into the next phase of the process, which is the actual assessment of the impacts, the specialist studies, the consultation, and then the drafting of the environmental impact assessment report and the environmental management program that indicates mitigation. There's consultation on that, and then ultimately there's a decision followed by an appeal afterwards. So these are just a couple of pictures around what could be the form and the nature of the specialist assessment. It could include flora. You can scan through the next couple of slides. I think the next one is fauna. Dealing with biodiversity risk. These are the types of developments and the types of impacts that are considered as part of the EIA process and that require or that are contained in the listing notices that deal with the specific types of development that require authorization. Next slide, please. And it ideally should identify risks before they occur, but we know that this is not always possible and things change over time and it's not always ideal. but EIA should potentially identify risk and avoid them as far as possible. Next slide, please. Some limitations and challenges of the EIA as it stands at the moment. I've listed here that competent authorities seldom refuse authorization, but this is not necessarily a bad aspect, because if your EIA process is run properly, the consultation and the investigation part of the process should ensure that the proposed development is adjusted to acceptable levels, which means that authorization can be granted and the development can occur because sufficient mitigation and avoidance has been provided for. The one aspect that is quite important is that because EIA is project specific, it cannot really deal with cumulative impacts adequately. So decision making happens on a project to project basis, and it really is difficult to look at medium long-term developments in the absence of a bigger picture by just using EIA. And then the fact is also that very few EIAs actually change the initial development proposal, and it's not necessarily because the initial development proposal was so good, but it's because of different reasons. So it's really a balancing act to try and ensure that sustainable development is the ultimate outcome of the process for each individual project that is under consideration. Then turning back to integrated environmental management, EIA is one of the instruments that is specifically mentioned in NEMA, but there's a whole range of other environmental instruments with associated powers, and these instruments include environmental management frameworks, strategic environmental assessments, risk assessments, feasibility assessments, norms and standards, etc., etc. If we also look at 24.2, it also deals with the ability of the Minister or the MEC to identify geographical areas based on environmental attributes and specified in spatial tools in which specified activities may be excluded from the requirement to obtain environmental authorization. So in certain instances, normally you would apply, run the EIA process and obtain an environmental authorization, but based on certain additional work, strategic work, it may be possible to exclude from this requirement to obtain an environmental authorization because the risks or the impacts are less. Next slide, please. This is a very bad example, in fact, because the area highlighted there is, in fact, the sensitive part of the area. I should have highlighted the residential part here, but this just goes to show that there is an ability to identify a piece of geographical area in which specific assessments have been done and based on which certain activities that would normally require authorization don't need to require authorization because there's no mitigation required, as there's no potential risk or impact that could be retained in the end after those assessments have been done. Next slide, please. Section 24.2 also allows for activities that may be identified that could be excluded from the environmental authorization requirement as long as they comply with certain prescribed norms or standards. And the next slide should show you an example of the Gauteng environmental management framework process that was followed for the entire Gauteng process. They have, or province, sorry, they have identified 5 zones in the Gauteng province, of which Zone 1 and Zone 5 have been identified for purposes of exclusion from the environmental authorization requirement. Zone 1, depicted in this picture, is the urban development zone, and it's really to promote development infill and densification and concentration of urban development in these zones. So the potential environmental impact is quite small. Some of the activities, therefore, have been excluded from the requirements of obtaining environmental authorization as long as they comply with the specifications that have been set in the standards that the Gauteng province have indicated that should be complied with as part of this exclusion. Next slide, please. And then the last component of Section 24.2 is the ability of the Minister or MEC to identify activities that, based on an environmental management instrument, may be excluded from the requirement to obtain an EA. And this could include any environmental management instrument. The next slide will show you the square kilometer array example where the entire area and the entire development was the subject of a strategic environmental assessment, a huge consultative process with a large amount of specialist assessment being undertaken. In the end, there was a whole chapter dedicated to what the development currently entails and what it will entail for phase one. And there was a specific chapter called an integrated environmental management plan based on which exclusion has been granted in a specific government gazette notice for this development to be undertaken on certain conditions. So this is an example of an environmental management instrument that was used in order to exclude from the environmental authorization component without losing all of the checks and balances that normally form part of the EIA process, but just on a bigger level. You can go to the next slide, thank you. Section 24.2a is the last example of integrated environmental management measures that I'm going to deal with, and it specifically gives the minister the power to prohibit or restrict any granting of an environmental authorization for activities that would normally require it if it's necessary to ensure the protection of the environment, the conservation of resources, or sustainable development. This has not been used in practice yet, although there is a couple of projects underway that attempt to consider whether this is a suitable method to be used to manage certain instances. But in this case, the competent authority would not accept further applications for environmental authorization if such a prohibition or restriction is in place, until that has been lifted, of course. And all applications that are pending would be deemed as withdrawn. And this obviously would not apply retrospectively to any authorizations that have already been issued before the prohibition or the restriction came into effect. All of these details are contained in the section of NEMA. Then moving on to the One Environmental System, we know that historically mining activities were primarily regulated under the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act. It required mining permit or right, prospecting, production or exploration rights, including an environmental management plan or program. It required water use licenses under the National Water Act, and it required environmental authorization or waste management licenses under NEMA or under the Waste Act. So this was the norm for many activities, but for mining it was different. For mining, this was only regulated under the MPRDA. The three respective departments, the National, the Province Water Department, and the Mineral Resources Department, had its own processes and its own set of information requirements and procedural requirements, so there was a complete lack of integration for mining. The whole process, application through until approval or decision-making, was cumbersome, it was uncoordinated, misaligned, and in many cases it resulted in litigation that could have been prevented if there were adequate measures in place to align. Regulated under NEMA. So there's one piece of legislation that governs this. Next. Environmental management inspectors or EMIs have to enforce environmental laws. And in this respect, it relates to mining specifically. And the associated legislation specifically made provision for the details that are currently in place. And then there are different sets of subordinate legislation, regulations, EIA, financial provisioning, appeals, exemptions, fees regulations, as well as residue stockpiles and deposits that have been developed over time in order to give effect to this. And the Water Act, as well as the Water Use License regulations, were also amended, and of course, the Mineral Petroleum Resources Development Act. So the perceived benefits of this is that there is improved cooperation between the various departments that have a role to play in this. There is reduction in overlapping of legal and procedural requirements. The public service is seen as one department to deal with, so DMRE is your go-to department to deal with all of these issues. And there's specific time frame challenges doesn't meet as regularly as we would have hoped to see. There are still some teething problems as far as reporting systems between the different departments are concerned. There's obviously issues around mandate, potential amendments being proposed in the current NEMLA 4 process, and there's also a process underway to amend the 2015 financial provisioning regulations. One of them is that there's a compliance date for those entities or holders of NPRDA rights of permits that still don't fall under the NEMA regime but continue to fall under the NPRDA regime until the transitional arrangements have been unpacked in sufficient detail to ensure that that they are capable of complying with the NEMA regime. And then there is a proposal in NEMLA 4 to expand the current Section 24P into general requirements contained in Section 24P itself, but then also a mining-specific provision contained in the proposed Section 24PA. And there's also a proposed amendment to the definition of financial provision, which I've just read in the previous slide. And the proposed amendment is quite important because it makes the scope of the term financial provisions a bit wider than what it is currently. And it would then be proposed to read that it means the amount that is to be provided in terms of the Act to guarantee the availability of sufficient funds to undertake progressive rehabilitation, etc., for activities to ensure mitigation, remediation, and rehabilitation of adverse environmental impacts, including latent environmental impacts and residual environmental impacts, as well as the pumping and treatment of extraneous and polluted water where relevant. The challenge is that in some cases or in some aspects, the term is still too limited because it's limited to activities that are listed or specified. And we've seen in practice over the past couple of years that in many cases, the transfer of mining rights, which is not an activity that requires environmental assessment and that doesn't really lend itself smoothly to the EIA process, is one of the aspects where there is an environmental risk and a potential loophole. So currently we can't require financial provision for the transfer of a mining right or permit because simply it isn't a listed or specified activity. So there's obviously more work to be done in this space. Next slide, please. Some of the principles that are also currently lacking either in NEMA or in the regulation is the power to prescribe instances wider for when financial provision is required, wider than is there currently. It's quite essential that the detail should be left to regulations, and we should perhaps consider the detail that's currently contained in NEMA and reduce that and leave it to the subordinate legislation to be developed over time as is required. Then there's no determination that progressive rehabilitation is provided for. The attempt would be that it's compulsory for someone to set aside financial provisioning for the purpose of ensuring progressive rehabilitation of impacts. There's also no principle at the moment that says it's compulsory for you to annually undertake these measures. There's a very good likelihood that people leave it over until the last couple of years of operation, and then the impacts are so vast that the money that has been set aside is not sufficient to deal with all the environmental impacts. There's also a principle required that says that financial provision should only be used for purposes of rehabilitation, remediation, and mitigation and not for any other purposes. And there is a need to limit the financial vehicles that could be used for this purpose. And then finally, the Minister of Mineral Resources may, of course, undertake measures to rehabilitate and use the financial provisioning set aside if the holder fails to do so. It should also make it a requirement that financial provision must be set aside, and it should be an offence not to. It's already provided for in the NEMLA proposed amendment. The scope of the financial provision should be focused on three aspects: annual rehabilitation, in other words, progressive rehabilitation, rehabilitation at the closure or the end of life of operations, and then any remediation of latent or residual impacts, in other words, impacts that are remaining after closure. Specialists must undertake the determination of the financial provision because it's quite a minefield, and the specialist is identified as an independent person or team of persons that has a variety of qualifications and skill sets that is required in this space in order to fulfill these requirements. And the purpose would be that the holder of a mining right or an environmental authorization must maintain and retain financial provision until a closure certificate is issued for that mining operation. They must review their liability every 3 years and adjust the funding accordingly and independently audit all of this work every 5 years. The Minister of Mineral Resources, in consultation with the Water Minister, may allow an annual drawdown of the fund if that is to be used to support final decommissioning and closure, and only in the last 10 years of operation. And the financial provision that remains at the issuing of a closure certificate, and the funds that were obviously for that period set aside for latent and residual environmental impacts, must at closure be transferred to the minister so that the minister can use the funds as the holder is no longer responsible. And then, of course, we need to ensure that the holders that were setting aside financial provision under the NPRDA regime convert to the NEMA regime over time. So the concluding remarks from my side is the One Environmental System, there's a variety of views about whether it was a victory or not. There's 11 competent authorities that implement one system. There's a fair amount of success in the implementation of the system. Of course, we know that there are developmental pressures versus environmental realities, and I've spoken earlier about the balancing act that is necessary in all of these instances. Sometimes there's a lack of strategic environmental context, but there's a lot of work that the department is doing in the form of the web-based environmental screening tool and also a number of strategic environmental assessments that have resulted in the use of alternative instruments to EIA to inform environmental management and decision making. And then there's also the ability for environmental considerations to influence planning, and that is probably one of the aspects that will in future require a lot more emphasis and hard work in order to achieve sustainable development. Thank you very much, Chairperson and Honourable Members and Acting DG. I think that concludes my presentation.
Well, thank you very much. In fact, I'm not the facilitator. The DG must lead. Thank you very much. Or you want me to take questions?
Yes.
Yes, 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 definitely.
So who is asking questions? Is it me?
Yes, you can answer.
Can I take Ben? Can I have some questions, Mr. Chair? Who else? Me, please, Chair. And who else? Me, please, Chair. You must also watch the chat, Chair.
Yes, we got our things here.
It's better to talk like we are doing. Can we start with Honorable Lorimer? We'll take other hand.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've got about 5 questions, I think. And thank you very much for a really useful presentation. I'm sorry time compelled you to go through it so fast. So it was very good. The first question is really, a cooperative governance question. What happens when the minister, if the minister and MEC disagree? It seems if an MEC wants a development, a minister is able to block it. Does that happen often? And does the reverse ever happen if the minister wants a development to go ahead against the wishes of an MEC? Does that happen? What would happen? Okay, that was number one. Number two, the assessment of the One Environment System. Is it your experience that most of the processes are dealt with within the set up 300 days? Just a rough guess at how many of them make that. That would be interesting. The third question is about the IPRC. Could you just take us through briefly again how that's supposed to work and why it's not working? The fourth question is to do with what you call progressive, which I think is the same as concurrent rehabilitation. It's my experience from mining that very little or any of this was being done, and there was no space in the financial provisioning for this procedure. So the mines would claim that they would not be able to get their hands on any of the financial provisioning to do rehabilitation right up until the end with closure. And then the fifth and final question is, how big is the problem of insufficient financial provisioning in mines? I mean, one hears stories that it's huge. Would you be able to give us an idea of the size? Thank you.
Honorable Winkler.
Thank you so much. Very informative presentation. Very excited to actually have a detailed, I think, breakdown of the relevant legislation. What I'd like to ask is, I'm dealing with a lot of water issues in KwaZulu-Natal especially, and I'd like to know whose jurisdiction does it ultimately fall under. So, for instance, the National Water Act now falls under DEF, I see, or there's a provision made for it. So when a water treatment center is not being properly maintained and there's regular sewage spills into rivers that completely degrade ecosystems and are a serious health threat to communities, who is actually then ultimately responsible? Do we approach the Department of Water and Sanitation or the Department of Environmental Affairs? Which minister is going to be ultimately responsible, because it does then ping-pong back and forth about who takes accountability, because obviously the water treatment centers, when they're not maintained and they pump raw sewage into rivers, it becomes a huge, I think, contravention of Section 24 of the Constitution, and environmental protection, which falls under DEF. So I just need to understand, when there are two concurrent departments, who does the buck stop at, basically. And then in terms of the environmental impact assessment, I just want to know what the exact parameters are that are being used when those are issued.
300-day period. Now, isn't that far too long? We have very good laws, from what I've heard, very good framework, but do we have the resources, financial and human resources, to be able to implement various aspects of the legislation, either at national, provincial, or even local level, because local is very, very much part of what happens, and I think Honorable Winkler would know more than anybody else about, the Durban region and air pollution, and even this morning's headlines in the newspaper, which I have read, cancer, deadly findings on toxic dumps in the Pietermaritzburg area. Now, so I'd like to know whether that this liaison and somebody else's liaison between the different spheres of government is really there and working well. For example, Chairperson, you have the Devon Metropolitan Open Space, the DMOS area. Is this a preserve of just the Durban municipality, or does National get involved? How do these things gel in place? And the last comment would be, I did hear that there are going to be amendments that are being proposed to NEMA, because the last amendment was in 2014. Could we have an idea of the nature of the amendments, and whether these amendments will take upon the need that we need to fast-track development in our country? The economy is at its lowest, everybody thinks crash, hasn't crashed yet, but it's almost crashing. So we need to ensure that we have the capacity as government to, if businesses want to come in and start businesses, that EIAs and things are not obstructionists in the way of taking more time than other countries may take to consider this, bearing in mind that we must not cut corners when we do these things. So those would be my few comments for now, Chairperson. Thank you.
Any other hand? Or Honorable Wepa, is she around?
Good morning, Chair. I am here. I didn't raise my hand. If I have questions, I will raise it. But thank you for recognizing me. Did you hear me? Hello?
you, Emma. Hearing you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Chair, I will ask you a question if you can hear me. Chair, can you hear me? I think we lost the Chair.
Honorable Singh, can you hear us? I think we've lost the Chair. Maybe you should step in as temporary Chair if you don't mind, sir.
I thought you were going to do that, DG, but in any case, I think we've lost the Chair, but Honorable Winkler? Honorable Weaver?
Deputy Chair, I just want to ask with the provisional financing, is this something that we've discussed? I see they say that every 5 years they will do independent audit. I would like to know when there's the next independent audit. And then I would like to know that, especially when it comes to mines, that when the mine is done 90% because of rehabilitation and the needle and all these things, the mine stops and say they're coming back to complete the 100%, but they never come back. So rehabilitation never happens. What system is in place to ensure that that is not happening? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Ruby. Any other questions of clarity at this stage while waiting for the chairperson? None, and then perhaps Acting DG and Amanda, you can respond to those queries. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Singh. I'm going to attempt to respond to some of the queries and questions, and then I'll ask Amanda to give us more detail because she has the more intimate knowledge of some of these provisions. In relation to Honorable Lorimer's question, in instances where ministers and MECs agree or disagree, usually what the process is, because this is a concurrent function, technically speaking, the environmental authorizations can happen at a national level as well as at the provincial level. So in some instances, the Act makes allowance for an MEC or the minister to agree that either one does it. So, for example, if it falls within the jurisdiction of the minister can, by agreement, agree that the MEC deals with a particular matter and vice versa. So, in instances where there is disagreement about a particular development, depending on who the competent authority in that instance is, there's processes that deal with how somebody who's in disagreement would deal with that matter. So, for example, if the minister issues a decision and a party to that process is in disagreement with the minister's decision, there's an appeal process. Usually the decision itself or the authority to issue the decision is delegated to a lower level official so that the MEC or the minister, depending on where the application sits, becomes the appeal authority. So that's an internal appeal or an administrative appeal process that resides within the department. So in essence, the decision for authorization is made. If there's unhappiness about that decision, then the person that's unhappy can then appeal that decision. And then a decision is made by the minister or the MEC, as the case may be, and then the further recourse in that instance is if you're still unhappy with that decision, and we know that sometimes it's the applicant or the person who's applying for the particular authorization. In other instances, it's community members or NGOs that are unhappy with the decision. Either of those parties, if they're unhappy with the outcome of a decision, of an appeal decision, then also have recourse to the court. So they can then take that decision on review to the court to ensure that whatever needs to be done in terms of the legislation has been done. So they can either attack either the procedure that was followed in making that decision, or else they can look at the substantive provisions. That means the actual content of the decision. They'd be able to go to court to challenge that decision. The other issue was in relation to the number of days, and acting chair and Mr. Lorimer also raised the issue around whether these EIAs get authorized within that period. I think I'm going to deal with both questions simultaneously. The purpose of all the amendments, as Amanda presented the slide to you, was in fact to deal with this issue around EIAs being blamed for delays when it comes to specifically infrastructure development. And Chair, I think we'll probably need a couple of hours just on that aspect alone to explain what we've done to expedite the EIA processes. And I think from our perspective, we've managed to, I think, deal with that issue quite significantly, because in the past it was always EIAs were always blamed for development not moving, and that hence we turned the system around, and there are strict time frames in relation to the issuing of a decision and how long it takes for a department to issue a particular decision. So in other words, the onus has been shifted. If you supply the department with all the necessary documents to make a decision, there's a regulated time frame within which that decision must be made. So if we've received that all the information relevant to that application, we are obliged to make a decision within that specific time frame. So then the next question asked by Honorable Lorimer was in relation to the IPIC. So when the original conceptualization of this One Environment system happened, the three departments that were mostly impacted were Environmental Affairs, Mineral Resources, and also Water. So the experience was that, and Honorable Singh, you talked about the ease of doing business. The experience was that in the mining sector, there was almost a fragmented approach to how we're dealing with authorization. So you would have an environmental impact assessment that you'd get from the Environment Department. Then you'd need a water use license from Water Affairs. Then you'd also need a mining license from the DMR, or DMRE as it's now known. So the purpose of the One Environment system was to make sure that we have that ease of doing business, and that you don't actually have to run around all over the place getting different authorizations. The purpose was to make sure that we can almost align the processes. And if you look at the One Environment system in terms of what it does in terms of time frames and what we used to have to deal with in the past as opposed to now, where your processes essentially have to run in parallel to get the environmental authorization, there's a big difference in terms of the time frames and how long it actually takes to get that particular authorization. So in other words, if you're going to be applying for a mining license, you apply for your EIA, you apply for your waste license, you apply for your water use license, and all that feeds into the mining permitting process as well, and the processes are run in parallel to each other instead of, you know, following on each other. So it shortens the time frame for the granting of that actual authorization. And then in relation to the issue around concurrent rehabilitation, Chair, I'm going to ask Amanda to be more specific. But my understanding of the provisions in relation to the regulations relating to rehabilitation is that we have three scenarios, and I'm going to ask you to expand on it. So the first scenario, I think it was Honorable Weber also, it addresses her question as well, is in relation to the concurrent rehabilitation. So what used to happen in the past is that you'd have an operation carrying on to its end of life, and once we reach the end of life, then everybody realized, okay, but now we need to rehabilitate. And as somebody indicated, you know, the provision for that is not necessarily or hasn't been in the past, always been there. So we then decided that if we're going to be doing the system of rehabilitation, we're going to take the approach where once you've done a particular activity for, and let's take mining as an example, if you've had a mining activity for, say, a year, on your balance sheet, you need to then make provision for rehabilitation for that particular year. So that takes care of the issue around the concurrent rehabilitation that Honorable Lorimer refers to. And the purpose of the financial provisioning regulations, among other things, was to deal with this issue of concurrent rehabilitation. Then there's also a period when you come to the end of life of a mine. And that period is also usually a very turbulent period, and it involves lots of money and assessments and whatever. So the second thing is that we've made provision for the period just pre and post closure of the particular mine. And then the third provision we have is in relation to what they call latent defects, or defects that we'll discover only after the mine has in fact been closed. So we've got three scenarios where we try to make provision for the rehabilitation. And in the past, that never happened. And that was why we've actually decided on a different regime for the rehabilitation aspect of environmental projects. Honorable Lorimer, I hope I've answered the question in terms of insufficient provisioning and how we then trying to mitigate that. In terms of, there is a fund that currently sits with the DMR, or that used to be with DMR, that was specifically for the purposes of rehabilitation, but the financial provisioning, as indicated, is to deal with these three different scenarios. Then, Honourable Chair, I'm going to go on to Honourable Winkler's issues related to water. There is a Department of Water and Sanitation. Their principal mandate is water. And I think the confusion comes in when we actually list the Water Act as a CEMA, or a Specific Environmental Management Act. That is basically to ensure that these acts sort of act in tandem with each other. But the actual jurisdiction for water and water-related issues, as you asked, where does the buck stop? So if you talk about sewage and that kind of thing, those wastewater treatment works and all that kind of thing, we had a similar question from the Human Rights Commission in relation to the VAR. And it's clear that the jurisdiction in relation to the water resources of the country sits with the Department of Water and Sanitation. As an effect of that not happening, obviously, we also, part of our mandate is also the air and the water and the soil. So we do get involved, and in relation to our involvement, we assist in relation to the compliance and enforcement matters, and that's where that provision of including them as a CEMA under the National Environmental Management or Management Act comes in. So we assist our colleagues and we work in tandem with each other. I think somebody also raised the issue of the how do we work with other spheres of government. Well, this is on a national level, and it's this horizontal integration that we do. So if there's issues that affect both departments, we then look at or try and tackle those issues together. Then the other issue that Honorable Winkler raised in terms of the EIAs and the exact parameters for the issuing of the EIAs, that process, Honorable Chair, is quite an intricate and complex process, in the sense that there's various factors that are considered in relation to when an authorization is granted, and it depends on a variety of factors. and variable. So one of the things is obviously the nature of the development that is being applied for. So, for example, if it's a mining application, it would have a different request for information as opposed to, say, I'm just using an arbitrary example, a lodge or something like that kind of thing. So there's different variables and there's different impact assessments that will be done. So, for example, if it's something that affects the water, you might need a hydrology or a hydrological study. If it's related to wind turbines, you might need an avifaunal study. So it is a fairly complex assessment of what the potential impacts would be. If she needs additional information, we can supply in terms of the actual process and how that works. Her last other question was in relation to funding for rehabilitation before we lost her, and what happens to if it's sold to another company. So we've tried, and I hope I've captured her question correctly. We have tried to make provision for those instances as well, where a company then takes over the rights and is then bound to the liability that's created as well. So if you sell your company, you sell it with your assets and liabilities, and that environmental liability attaches to the authorization. The authorization is obviously transferred into the name of the new company, and that liability attaches to the new authorization. Excuse me for a second, Chair. Then Honorable Paulson was talking about the NEMA bill and the fact that there is unhappiness in relation to the fact that the Minister of DMRE signs off on the EIA processes. Let me deal with that one first. So as part of the One Environment system, there was quite a bit of unhappiness that the DMR would be actually be issuing the environmental authorization. And there were comments that how can we give a department who has a mining mandate the power to issue an authorization. So in terms of explaining how the One Environment system works, is that the Department of Environmental Affairs is responsible for drafting the legislation that has to be complied with. So even though the DMR issues the authorization, they have to comply with the legislation. So there's the nine provincial competent authorities that can issue authorization. There's the Minister of Environment that can issue authorization. And then there's also the DMR minister that can issue authorization. So in essence, there's 11 competent authorities. I've already mentioned that if there's unhappiness with a decision by any of these competent authorities, the first step would be to actually then lodge an internal appeal against that decision. So specifically in relation to the minerals side of things, one of the safeguards that they wanted us to put into place was to ensure that we don't lose the oversight of the environmental impact assessment side of things. So if there's a decision made by the DMRE in relation to the environment aspect or the environmental authorization aspect, that appeal lies with the environment minister. And I think that distinction is very, very important. So the decision maker is the DMRE, but the appeal for the environmental aspect lies with the minister. So that was the safeguard that was built into the system to ensure that there's no abuse of the system and that ultimately we don't move the environmental mandate away from the department completely and that it still falls within our core mandate. The issue around municipalities doing EIAs, Honorable Paulson, I think maybe it's just a slight misunderstanding in relation to how that works. The municipalities are allowed to issue only certain types of authorizations, specifically under the Air Quality Act. And that's usually preceded by an environmental impact assessment, so they don't actually do the EIA as such. Their competence lies with in relation to the emissions and under the Air Quality Act. So I hope that clarifies it for you, sir. The issue around the impact of the bill on EIA is the amendment doesn't really impact the authorization process. As I've indicated, you've got the 11 competent authorities in terms of EIAs, and those will remain. So that responsibility resides with that competent authority concerned. And as I said, there's also the safeguard in terms of the appeals process and also the ultimate review to court if there's unhappiness with the appeal decision. Honorable Singh, as you can see, just from what I'm saying, you'll definitely need a detailed presentation on each aspect of the legislation. Because as you go into the regulation, the complexity becomes evident. So I think we probably need 3 weeks to go through the legislation adequately. So I must agree with you that that would be required if you want that detail. Then in relation to your point around the regulations, Honorable Singh, the issue is that we are obliged before we pass regulations, or the minister is, that we table those regulations in Parliament, and that's part of almost the consultation process in relation to the regulation and the oversight that Parliament exercises there. So without us tabling those regulations and allowing for that the regulated period within which we are expected to get comment from Parliament, if we don't follow that process, it obviously impacts on our procedural acceptance, shall we say, of the regulation. So if we don't follow the process, they can challenge the regulation. So that is mandatory, and I would agree that the Secretariat should make the regulations available. Honorable Singh, I've in a sense addressed your issue around the ease of doing business. The issue of EIAs, and I think this is an argument that has been used internationally as well. The fact that the mandate of environment has come to the fore recently has sort of almost become a problem for certain businesses, because they're looking for shortcuts or trying to evade the environmental liability, so to speak. So what we've done there is we the Act also makes provision for not necessarily only an EIA as the be-all and end-all of the environmental impact assessment process. So the Act and part of the amendments that we've made to the Act look at alternative instruments. So if, for example, you have and I'll use an arbitrary example once again, a strategic environmental assessment for a particular area. It makes life easier, because you then don't have to look at each specific site in detail. So you have a general view of the area, and you look at site-specific issues in terms of the assessment of the EIA. Alternatively, if you have a common development activity like maybe a substation or even a tower or something to that effect, there's certain standard things that have to happen in relation to those applications. So you might then want to develop a set of norms and standards or something to that effect as an alternative to an EIA, which then still takes care of the environmental mandate, as you said, because we don't want to compromise that in any way, but it doesn't mean that you have to go through the complete EIA process. And in that regard also, we have a shortened what we call a basic assessment process in relation to EIAs. That also has its own requirements and qualifications, but it's much shorter than the 300-day period that was referred to. So there's that long period where it's complex, and you have to have proper scoping of the impacts and that kind of thing. And then you have a shorter process, which is a basic assessment, which is less complex and which goes through a shortened process almost, but because there are certain things that we will not need to investigate as thoroughly because of the nature of the particular development. Then I see the other issue was in relation to how we work with the different spheres of government. Usually in relation to the EIA space, if, for example, there's a decision that needs to be made by a particular sphere of government, that is usually sent off to the other departments for comment and within a specific time period as well. So if it impacts on another government department, we work with each other. So, for example, if there is a development in, let's say, Durban area, the Durban Metro would be one of the commenting authorities kind of thing. So there is that gelling and that working together. Also, in relation to things like, for example, our compliance and enforcement, because we have such you mentioned the issue of capacity. We have relatively limited capacity at national. So what we do then is we use the provincial and the local authority capacity for those kind of things. So as far as possible, we try and do that cooperative governance as far as possible, because we don't have the capacity nationally, so we have to utilize our networks to actually achieve the issues around enforcement and compliance specifically. Honorable Singh, we've made a presentation on the NEMLA to the portfolio committee also. We can probably forward that, because you asked about the nature of the amendments to the EIA. And then also your last comment was in relation to us not wanting it to be obstructionist. I think my comments in relation to the alternative instruments and that kind of thing has addressed that issue. Then, Honorable Weber, I think in relation to the provisional financing, there's a stipulation in the financial provisioning about when audits are supposed to happen. So, for example, a facility would, I can't remember the exact time frame, but I think it's a five-year period within which they do and redo their audits. Or if circumstances change and they're coming towards closure, there's a provision. But Amanda can be a bit more specific if needs be in relation to when those audits actually happen. Then in relation to the issue I've mentioned around rehabilitation, and you talked about the 90%, and we tried to address that as well in relation to the three areas I've mentioned to ensure that there is adequate provisioning for rehabilitation. Chair, I think I've addressed all the queries. I'll allow Amanda to add if I've missed anything, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think, DG, you've really addressed, I think, most of the issues. Just maybe some additional points on the financial provisioning questions that were raised. I think some of the aspects that the questions were directed at, and that some of the inputs in the slides have tried to indicate, are not sufficiently addressed either in NEMA at the moment or in the regulations. And that is why you will see the proposed amendments to the definition of the term financial provision, as well as the section 24P and PA that deals specifically with financial provisioning in NEMLA. And I've talked about the process underway to address some of these aspects in the financial provisioning regulations as well. And some of these things we've only picked up because we have dealt with DMRE and we've dealt with the legislative framework. I think we must re-emphasize again that as a result of the One Environmental System, the Environment Minister sets the environmental legislative framework, and this includes aspects relating to market purposes, which I think leads me to the specific question about the indication I've given around transfers of mining rights. The aspect that is of concern there is that transfers of these rights are not specifically procedurally governed under the MPRDA. We've spoken about about the transfer of the liabilities that go with that, the process isn't clear enough and isn't clearly enough set out in legislation to avoid those kinds of loopholes. So NEMLA is an attempt to all sorts of checks and balances being built into the current NEMLA process to try and address the aspects that we have identified up until this point. I will stop there. I don't think there's anything.
What is the process and how do we ensure that compliance is enforced when another department is a repeat offender? Thank you.
Montavada, did you want to ask something, or did I see your name come up? Are we done now, colleagues, with this, on the understanding that...
Ahmed Skumza Mchanga, who is the chief director responsible for biodiversity management in the department, together with her team, the special kingdom, the speculant Karoo, and also Maputaland, the Pondoland that goes up to Mozambique, the Cape Floral Kingdom. It's quite unique because it's one out that you don't have productivity, you don't have food, you don't have any other thing that you need, that things that are required and needed economically. So the sector itself has gone through a lot of it. The Biodiversity Act, which was enacted in 2004, was informed by a number of obligations that we have, some of which we have nationally, some of which utilization of genetic resources has to be fair. The access to the resources has to be fair. So natural sites, natural landscapes, we do have a framework within which the international agreements, some of which I referred to, are implemented and are ratified here in South Africa, because they carry certain obligations that would have to make sure that the South African National Biodiversity Institute, which is SANBI, which provides the science and research and the monitoring. Chapter 3 of NEMBA deals with biodiversity planning and monitoring. We understand that for us, biodiversity, develop a biodiversity management plan following the guidelines provided in the Act, and then have the minister. Can we move on to the next? This is also another form of protection of biodiversity. The other one is the use of those ecosystems. We haven't used that. With trade, you know, like domestic trade in rhino horn, there are regulations that we've just NEMBA deals with species and organisms posing potential threats to there are alien and invasive species that would require specific attention. They are already used, but there are protocols that deal with this from a biosecurity perspective as and when they are being introduced. So there are specific regulations from a regulatory perspective dealing with genetically modified organisms. The GMO Act is a GMO Council. The council itself comprises a number of people looking at different aspects of the introduction, who need to deal with risk assessments. Whether it's a certain trait that is going to make maize to be more resistant, the department, or through the GMO Act, we are obliged as the department, as a sector, biodiversity, to look at on biological resources or biological and ecosystems and species, some of which would we look at that whole chain as to what are the other aspects through that whole value chain that need to be managed. And the GMOs Act indicated, and also the Katakina Protocol, as I indicated earlier on, that deals with living modified organisms. Can we move on? And benefit sharing, which is the third objective of the Act itself. I've indicated that species and prospect and use those resources to develop nutritional related aspects or cosmetic accessing a resource. There is someone who is accessing a resource, and there should be certain agreements that are entered into. And those agreements may come agreement, giving that transfer to the other to be able to access. And in that, the department, through this act, beneficiary will provide and permit that would look at the agreements of the it's a transactional, financial transactional related type of an agreement, whether that is fair or it's not fair. Implementation, the provisions of the Nagoya Protocol, which will then look at compensation for the indigenous fund, and that fund will then be transferred to the for the protection of that species or transferred to the holders of that knowledge. The DSI, which is the department responsible for science and innovation, and also DTI on a number of aspects that the species, but also on the other hand, protect the holders of knowledge and make sure that there's fairness in the sharing of benefits to that. If I need to indicate here that there are contestations in the space, in the aspect of you reference to CITES regulations and other regulations, TOPS regulations to that effect, and also working with provinces only towards more conservation oriented. There are aspects associated with that, so and different philosophies that are punted by different to indicate as well that we are working on a review, a number bill, that is looking at a number of aspects. Earlier on with the first presentation are aligned, so we did not want to have in the Act appeals process when it's already defined. Providing certain exemption clauses on certain aspects that may be exempted from permit requirements and certain things that we have looked at, but there are other areas that are still need attention. One of those is the area around a member bill and also the NEMLA process. There are certain aspects that are also being considered, which are not part now. Thank you, Chairperson, Honorable Members, and the D. PGF colleagues.
Chairperson, I see you are back. Honorable Tata. I was taking questions early on, but I see you are back.
I take questions then.
Anna, please.
Okay. Winkler. Maybe let's start asking questions. Those will follow, the others will follow. Honorable Winkler.
Friends of presentation. I think you're very right to point out that there are a number of contentious issues in this space, especially pertaining to the for example, what is sustainable use in terms of the broader context of the sixth mass extinction and the international as well as the climate crisis, and how to set out specific parameters for what that actually means so that there's not too much of a is, I think, promoted over more protectionist use of the environment. Issue surrounding wildlife, there seems to be a problem that, again, issues are ping-pong between really want to take responsibility for who has to oversee the welfare provisions, what the welfare provisions are. Very area that needs serious consideration. Then in terms of the TOPS regulations, I'd like to know, how is it possible that we have TOPS regulations hunting of lions? I'm just not understanding how one can coexist with the other. As you say, it's going to take these contentious issues into consideration. What is the timeline? Who is going to be allowed to
thank you very much, Chairperson. I'd just like to know the Indigenous knowledge system. In terms, it resides with science and innovation, but obviously it also what benefit has communities derived from having their indigenous knowledge make sure that that happens, that there is benefit to communities where that indigenous knowledge the environment is the one area that can produce the most sustainable jobs in terms of protecting from, for example, bioprospectors who come and take whatever exists in our environment for their own commercial. The special budget we environmental scouts go out and make sure that there's no
and the harmful impact of certain GMOs and some large companies coming into South Africa here resides with the environment, but I think I will put appropriate questions on the question of GMOs. Chairperson, my specific query will relate to the alien species, etc. I mean, to what extent do we have the capacity? It comes back again to my earlier question, the capacity to deal with alien species, the eradication of alien species, educating our population about what alien species are, and living up to the protection of our biodiversity. My second question would relate to wetlands, which fall under the Biodiversity Management Act. Is there any threat of any of our wetlands being delisted for activities that should not be taking place either in or surrounding these wetlands? And perhaps we could be told if that's happening. And then my last question would be, with the COVID pandemic, has this division been able to see whether or not there's been any difference in biodiversity, natural habitat? For example, in other countries in the world, we see the return of birds, we see the return of certain plant species. Has that kind of exercise been done? And at some stage, will it be done so we know, you know, what the cause and effects are? Thank you.
Any other hands?
The person, Honourable Weber. Weber,
Honourable
Weber. Thank you, Jay. I think this is I'm not sure how to word this. We have a very rich diversity of reptiles which are not allowed to actually be exported unless done by a legal breeder, and you can only be bred as that reptile to be exported. Now, this creates quite a lot of tension, because every province has their own environment, can make their own environmental law, which creates a lot of problems because they're very different from one another and they're actually opposing. So I think my first question will be to have one national environmental law regarding, well, biodiversity, not only for reptiles, that every province then can have a guideline to what their measures and regulations should be. Then my second question is, what do we do and how can we build into our Biodiversity Management Act the protection of these animals? For instance, if we can have a list, for instance, of the illegal breeders, of the legal breeders of reptiles, so that when they go to a ship or to airports or everything where they actually are exported from, that they can actually check this list, because at this stage they can get a permit by anyone. If they say, I'm a legal breeder and I bought it from another legal breeder, and that person that bought it from a legal breeder can actually export. So my question basically there is, what regulations do we actually in our Biodiversity Management Act built in to protect our animals from being exported illegally? Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Yes, sorry, Chair, my last question is Honourable Weber again. My last question is specifically to the biodiversity of our trees in our country that's been cut off for trade, but they're not being replaced. What is the action steps and how can we prevent this from happening, or how can we manage this through our measures and regulations that when trees are cut off for firewood and being sold, which is understandable, but it needs to be replaced. Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Can I ask the acting DG to facilitate responses?
Thank you, Chair. I'll try and respond to some of the issues quickly, and then I'll hand over to the DDG. In relation to Honourable Winkler, the issues around the grey areas in relation to exploitative use and sustainable use, we've noted those concerns. Just in terms of the issue around welfare, Chair, last year, or at one of our sittings with the Portfolio Committee, last year, the issue around welfare was specifically raised during the when we presented the amendment in relation to the NEMLA. And the committee, in fact, requested us to specifically include a provision related to welfare under the Biodiversity Act. The issue around the regulations and the TOPS regulations and the hunting of lions, Chair, in terms of that process, I think we need to draw the distinction between our wild lion populations and our captive bred populations. And I think DDG Shoni will give you more clarity in relation to that. In relation to the Biodiversity Bill, that bill is in process and there's still going to be a comprehensive consultation process that will be undertaken, and the Act specifically requires us to do an extensive consultation process. I think it's provisions sections 99 and 100 specifically that talk about consultation in the current Act. But in relation to all our legislation, there is a process that we follow to garner input from the industry, from all relevant role players, the citizens of our country, and obviously during the parliamentary process as well, the committee is allowed, should make intervention in terms of the legislation and anything that they would like to see contained in the legislation. Then, Honourable Paulson, in terms of the indigenous knowledge, the access and benefit sharing is specifically designed to ensure that the indigenous knowledge systems benefit the communities from which they are derived. So the process that you talk about, who oversees this process, is in fact the department. The minister issues permits in relation to the use of indigenous resources as well as indigenous knowledge, and there's a provision that relates to how, there's a mechanism that is designed to ensure that if there are bioprospectors that are coming here to use our natural resources, that there is no theft of the species, so to speak. In other words, if they're using a natural resource, there must be some benefit to the communities that attach to that resource. And similarly, with the indigenous knowledge that attaches to those communities as well, there must be some form of compensation, and that's managed through a trust fund into which monies are paid, and those benefits then accrue to the relevant communities from which that either the indigenous knowledge itself or the resource is derived. Honourable Singh, in terms of the alien species, there's a comprehensive program that DDG Shoni will deal with in relation to particularly our EPWP projects and how we look at the eradication of alien invasive species, specifically from the department's perspective and more specifically in relation to our protected areas. I'm going to allow him to speak to the wetlands issue, because that's his area of speciality or his staff. In relation to the issues around the difference in our environment, specifically after the advent of COVID, I think naturally the natural environment will in and of itself have recovered to quite an extent because there's obviously less pollution, less flights and that kind of thing. But I think specifically around the protection of our biodiversity, that function's been an ongoing function throughout lockdown and whatever else. So, and we've seen quite a reduction in terms of the numbers of animals poached and that kind of thing as well. Although in some areas there have been different types of interventions that we've found in relation to illegal poaching, for example, the use of dogs and that kind of thing. So there definitely have been some effects on our natural environment, Honorable Singh. Then I'm going to ask Dinesh Shoni to also talk to the issue of the reptiles, but I'll address the issue in relation to Honorable Weber's question around the provinces making their own laws. As I said earlier, Chair, the issue is that environment is a concurrent function. So the purpose of national government would be to draft the framework legislation, and that would be the legislation that goes through this committee and obviously the NCOP. There are obviously provincial, there is a provision for provincial legislation to be drafted. However, it can't be less stringent than the national framework or national legislation. So in other words, the provincial legislation has to almost defer to the national legislation in a sense. It can, however, be stricter. So for a particular province and for their particular circumstances, they can craft their own legislation which would make certain requirements, stricter than the national legislation. Then the second point in this regard, Chair, is that we are well aware that there might be different pieces of legislation and that in some instances they don't necessarily talk to each other. So from that perspective, the committee might be aware of the rationalization of legislation process that has been undertaken by the department. And part of that process, Chair, is to address precisely the issue raised by Honorable Weber. So that's why we're looking at how, and Dinesh Shoni mentioned in his presentation, the issue around how appeals are dealt with. So, for example, something like appeals across the CIMAs, what we're trying to do is bring uniformity so there's a single process, legislative process that deals with that. And that the rationalization process will extend, obviously, to all the provinces also in an attempt to ensure that we obtain that almost uniformity in terms of application of the legislation. But in some instances, as I said, the provinces may need something more than what we've given them, in which case they can make their particular legislative requirements stricter than the national. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. Thanks, DG. I will talk to some few, and then colleagues will also come in quickly. We'll make it short. I think as we have highlighted, the issue of sustainable use, as much as in the CBD is qualified and defined, has always had so many interpretations. Things have changed so much over time that it requires attention. You are right, Honorable Winkler, that the international platform on biodiversity and ecosystem services that we are party to has prioritized this as one of the priority areas to create a specific program that is going to help define this, looking at it from a scientific perspective. And to that extent, I don't know whether it's going to set up parameters, but I think it's going to a proper that will assist parties and countries or to be able to interact with this and formulate policy measures with a global understanding. Of course, we do understand that there may be specific aspects that are peculiar to specific regions, but certain principles should apply. We are part of that program, and we are participating effectively through the membership of our members from SANBID and the department as well. So the outcome, I think, would assist. Even in the CBD space, now we are negotiating a new deal for nature and people, and that post-2020 global biodiversity framework, this issue of sustainable use being defined, it's coming through. Our understanding and our posture has always been, and is still the same, that sustainable utilization, conservation, fair and equitable sharing of benefits arising from the resources should always form part of the tenet of what biodiversity management should be. Whether you're looking at it from a CBD perspective or looking at it from a constitutional perspective, from a legislative perspective, also in practice, all of these three things complement each other. You will protect things that you attach value to, but also on the other hand, you have to protect things and genetic resources for them to provide you with value. Whether that value comes through ecosystems, goods and services, it's also an issue that you would also have to consider in the protection. So we'll always be looking at this issue and we forever try to clarify consistently on the basis and as a matter of principle. The welfare aspects, the acting DG spoke to that. Suffice to say that we welcome the initiative by the Portfolio Committee to set aside time, I think it's on the 25th or 26th of August, that the PC has invited the department together with the department responsible for agriculture. Hopefully, maybe NSPCA and others will also be party to that, so that we can focus specifically on welfare and related matters. The Animal Protection Act is very, very clear on certain aspects of, aspects of welfare. We also understand the case law that came through judgments even against the department, talking to and prescribing that we have to consider animal welfare in decision-making processes. I think the reference that we've made to say in the member bills and in the process going ahead, even in NEMLA, the aspects of well-being are taken into consideration to try and make sure that there are specific provisions that would allow the minister to also take certain measures within the framework of the law in this regard. So we're looking at that without taking anything away from agriculture. And we have agreed, the two ministers recently met and agreed that there should be cooperation on a number of things, including on this particular matter, between the two departments, which is underscoring some of the technical interfaces that we've always had before that. I'll request Marcel to talk to the aspects related to reptiles and the export in the context of TOPS and interface with other with provinces, underscoring what the ADG indicated, that the harmonization of legislation, we undertook some an exercise some years back to ask and request within our cooperative governance processes provinces to harmonize their legislation, biodiversity and protected areas legislation, with the national legislation. And we've made a lot of strides in there. There are some few other areas, of course, that still need to be tightened up. And through all these amendments, I think we'll be able to deal with that. On the issue of wetlands, the ADG referred to the program. The NBA, which is the National Biodiversity Assessment, did indicate that wetlands are one of those ecosystems that are least protected and heavily impacted. Hence, the investments that are there, working on wetlands from a reactive perspective, but also we need to be proactive in providing protection measures. Our Ramsar attention was meant to this big national wetlands of international importance, 26 I referred to. There are many other thousands of wetlands that need to be protected through legislative and other means. So we are looking at this in the context of part one. We are looking at this in the context of strategic water sources, including wetlands, to afford them a program. We have started, I think Skunga can talk to that as well, a process that we call a development of a joint framework on wetlands management in South Africa. Ourselves, working with Water Affairs, working with Agriculture and other partners, so that we have a joint policy framework that will, for the first time, indicate the interfaces between the three of us and others in the management of wetlands. There are programs within Zambia as well that prioritizes the classification of wetlands in different categories to show which ones need immediate intervention, and many other issues that still need to be done, including the reactive measures that I've spoken about to rehabilitate those that are. But wetlands have to be protected at all costs, as part of protecting our water resources in South Africa, as part of strategic water sources that we have. We have a dedicated program specifically on that that we can talk to at any other time. On the GMO side, risk assessment, from our side, Honorable Singh, health will look at the health impact. Agriculture will look at the agricultural impact. DSI will look at the science aspect and biotechnology of associated with this. We look at risk assessment as in the potential negative impact to biodiversity in particular. And then we run that assessment. When a collective decision is taken by the GMO Council for recommendation for minister to approve or not approve, they will have to take that into consideration. Where science is not adequate, we've got extended networks through universities and others that come on board to assist us in dealing with risk assessments on this particular aspect. Alien investors, of course, there's a program that ADG spoke to. We invest a lot of money in this. The results and the yields, as much as sometimes we talk about jobs created, there's also a lot of positives in terms of ecosystems being functional again and restored. So there are multiple benefits, social benefits, ecological and also economic benefits in this type of investment. I was looking at some of the stats on interventions that were done in catchments around Western Cape after the drought. And looking at it in the context of drought, the yield after the removal of those investments, quantified and qualified in cubic meters, was so significant that if you put rents and cents into it, it's better to put a lot of money in the rehabilitation and also avoiding further impact and further introduction than reacting. But it does help to also deal with where the problems are at the moment. The biosecurity program is also being enhanced in the department to deal with the introductions and detect those before they get into the country. That's like learning from other countries as well in that space. I'll request colleagues to look at the breeding and farming. Suffice to say that part of this work is being looked at in the panel that Minister had spoken to at some point, which is also looking at this aspect of breeding. But lions have referred to, we've got more than 3,500 or so lions in the world. We call them wild lions. And they interface with wild managed lions, of course, 3,500. And then you then have this aspect that of captive breeding that not only go into lions, it also goes into other species. Some of it is done in the sanctuaries for reintroduction. Some of it is done for other species in relation to trade. And any captive facility in any of the provinces would have to get a particular permit to do that. And such permit would prescribe the do's and don'ts. Of course, the biggest aspect here is the one that I referred to on how welfare matters are taken care of in that space. So there's an issue of policy analysis in this particular matter insofar as it relates to the Hannibal family. Can we get Martel, Sunga, Olga, or Paul on the fighter side to come in quickly, short?
Thank you, DDG, and morning, honorable members. I would like to respond to the question from honorable Singh in respect of the threat to wetlands. Indeed, as the DDG has indicated, there are many threats to wetlands, and most of these have already been outlined in the National Biodiversity Assessment, which was concluded and launched by the Minister last year. And they include threats around mining, pollution, climate change, land degradation, large-scale plantations, alien plants, eradication is very important in that regard, as well as fires. As you would recall, South Africa is a signatory to the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands. And as the DDG has indicated, we have 26 of our wetlands of international importance listed in terms of that convention. Now, two of our prestigious wetlands, which is the Orange River Mouth in Northern Cape, as well as Black Box Spray in Gauteng, are included in what is called a Montreux Record, which is the record of sites which are seriously under threat. We have been working with all stakeholders as part of the National Committee on Wetlands to ensure that we put in measures to ensure effective conservation of these areas. I think the DDG has spoken to the issue around policy, but in terms of implementation on the ground, we have concluded a management effectiveness tracking tool, which basically looks at all the threats in each of these areas and comes up with interventions. In respect of the Orange River Mouth, we have met also with all the relevant stakeholders, and we do have an action plan that we are currently implementing, and we are hoping that in a year or so, we should be able to take Orange River Mouth out of the list of red sites. We are also working with the Gauteng Department to make sure that Black Box Spray is also removed from the Mantra Report. But there's a lot of measures in place for wetlands. We are also pursuing rehabilitation and restoration of these wetlands through the Working for Wetlands program, which continues to provide the much-needed support for restoration and rehabilitation. And since the inception of that program in 2000, around 1.3 billion has already been invested in 1,500 wetlands, resulting in the creation of about 37,000 jobs. So there's a lot that's happening on the ground, and I think we are on track in terms of ensuring that these areas, which are important for water security, are being managed effectively as a country. Thank you.
Thank you, DDG. Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. There's just one area or one or two areas that I just want to add on before I get to the question on the reptiles and the provincial legislation. It was a question by Honorable Member Polser regarding how we make sure that communities benefit from bioprospecting activities. Acting DG mentioned the funds that are paid into a trust fund and being it goes to communities. But one additional area to make sure that is quite important, and that's something that is required in terms of NEMBA, is that there must be a benefit sharing agreement of how communities will benefit, and that agreement must be signed off by the minister. So I think that's an important tool that is also used to ensure that communities do benefit from the use of the indigenous knowledge. Then I want to come back to Honourable Member Weber's question on, and it's sort of touching on the concurrent competence, the legislation by provinces, making their own legislation, and the question around reptiles. It's definitely an area that we have picked up that is a concern regarding reptiles removed from the wild. And we do acknowledge that the province's legislation differ, and a particular province will not necessarily regulate species or protect species that are not necessarily indigenous to that particular province. And that creates the problem. That is where the national legislation then comes in. So what we have picked up in the trade in Westpaw, and we factored that into, I think DG referred to the TOT regulations, someone referred to the TOT regulations now that have been amended. We have proposed a number of reptiles to be included in the amended TOPS list to be afforded protection at a national level. The problem is that responding by legislation sometimes is we cannot respond 5 years by the time that we implement the legislation. Some time has gone by, and then there are new species that need to be included in the list. So we will also be looking at amending the list that we will be publishing now to already review that list, which is also a lengthy process, but to continuously try and keep up of what warrants protection at the national level. In terms of the concurrent competence, what I just want to highlight, at the question that was asked in the previous presentation regarding consultation on our legislation and how do we deal with the fact that provinces may have different legislation to what we have at national level. How do we deal with that? And if there are differences, which we try to prevent, but it's inevitable that may arise, how do we deal with that? And NEMA requires us to submit all subordinate legislation to, if it's a regulation, to submit it to Parliament 30 days prior to promulgation. And if it's other subordinate legislation, at least approval by the NCOP. So we do that consultation process in terms of Section 146 of the Constitution, which deals with conflict between national and provincial legislation. So if it's regulations and we submit it to Parliament, we table it with the NCOP and we table it with the National Assembly. The NCOP, we do need approval so that if there is conflict between provincial legislation and national legislation, then the national legislation will prevail. And in the conflict, I mean, it's something that is so different that it's impossible for a person to comply with both the provincial requirements and the national requirements. That would be conflict. But if it's different, but a person can comply with both at the same time, that's not necessarily conflict. So we have the parliamentary approval processes. So at the moment, the amended TOPS regulations and the amended elephant nonsense standards are with Parliament. And EDG mentioned the norms and standards for trophy hunting of leopard that will soon be tabled for the parliamentary approval processes. And then lastly, how do we, the last part that I want to touch on is how do we prevent the illegal export of, for example, species or reptiles, and referring to, member Weber referred to keeping a list of breeders. What the amended TOPS regulations, the ones that are now currently subject to the NCOP approval process, what that will require is that all captive breeding facilities must keep a stock book in which they will need to provide numbers coming into the facility and numbers going out of the facility, for example, when they sell that. And then also a stat book where they will be required to keep or to do a DNA analysis. And that is for the purpose of determining which offspring come from which mother and which father. So, and also marking of the specimen. The intention with that is if a captive breeder wants to export anything from that captive facility, these measures will then enable them to prove that a particular specimen actually comes from that particular captive breeding facility and not from elsewhere. So that's one of the requirements that we built into the new, it is already in the current TOPS regulations, but it's not as explicit. So we strengthened it in the amended TOPS regulations to require that needs to be done. Those are the, thanks CDGs, and Honourable Chair, those are the areas that I just wanted to respond on regarding the differences in the legislation and the illegal export trade in the red style.
Thank you very much. I hope Acting DDG have covered everything.
Yes, we tried. I think
yes.
Chairperson, just one clarity from me, Singh, please. Short one.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I understand the whole issue of regulations and that the department is complying by tabling these with Parliament. And the way it's tabled with Parliament, it's placed or printed in the AGCs, which I saw yesterday. What I'm saying, in addition to that legislative requirement, if the Portfolio Committee, which is us, that is responsible for DEFF matters, receive the text of the proposed regulations on or about the same time that it's tabled in Parliament, because it gets lost in the whole Parliament thing, then we could consider it probably as a committee or as individuals and make our comments if we need to. So that's the request that I make. Thank you.
Okay. If there are no further discussions, was that the last item for today in terms of the program?
Chairperson, there's two other presentations, but I don't think we'd be able to do it, so I think we'd have to decide how we're going to manage those. Either they start off tomorrow morning, because I think we should have allowed at least an hour and a half for each of these very important presentations and discussion.
In fact, that's why I was asking, because I was looking at the time, what do we say? Should we shift this to tomorrow? I think the proposal that Honorable Singh, you made, that this thing is necessary. We might need to do it quarterly, take it bit by bit, and instead of rushing through as we are doing. But I don't know. I suspect because we need to be ready for the for Parliament in the afternoon. Can we still take one presentation? I'm asking members in particular because we are the ones who are going to be under pressure. Can we take one?
I'm sorry, I had a problem of connectivity. But my problem is that we are squashing this legislation into a small space. And legislation, it takes time. If you look at those who just go for legislation and lessons, it takes about a year or more than a year, and we are crashing. I thought myself that we would firstly deal with the NEMA Act, which is the Bible, so that all of us understand this Bible by heart. But it's just to say we have done the workshop, but what is the impact of that workshop to the members of Parliament?
We agree with that. That's why I'm saying Honorable Singh is right to say maybe after this overview, then we'll want to go through each one of them, give us ourselves time. But now, I'm just asking for now.
Now, it's 3 minutes left
Yes, so we suggest that we do it tomorrow. We start with this one tomorrow. Okay, that's a suggestion. I don't think there's any other view unless it can be indicated. Would ask acting DG, you can hear the appeal is to say we'd want to have more time. Focusing on some of this. I know we were the ones who were demanding that. Let's start on it. So I would suggest that let's shift what we were supposed to do today, what is left to tomorrow, then rearrange, taking into account also this appeal that says would need more time. And that more time, for now, it's a proposal that we can do it quarterly, I think, take into account all of those and then come back to us with, but tomorrow let's do something as well. Let's continue with the work that we're doing. Is that fine with the organizers of the workshop?
Thank you, Chair. We'll comply. We were scheduled for tomorrow. We'll just rearrange the schedule to have these presentations done tomorrow, Chair, and we'll have to move the others up. We've also noted the requirement for the additional quarterly presentation, and we'll be liaising with the Secretariat in this regard, Chair, to schedule whatever meetings are required as per the committee's request, Chair.
Okay. No, thank you very much. Otherwise, we thank you for the presentation so far. I think the questions themselves are indicating that we are keen to know. It will actually impact even on your work as a department as we begin to understand what we are, what the law says. And it is giving us an opportunity as well to interact with you as we ask questions. Otherwise, thank you very much. It was good for this session. I know the attendance was not that good. I think we'll follow up on that. I'm also getting, I also got affected, this network problem. But I think as we move, we'll sort out all of those. Meeting is adjourned, or workshop is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you tomorrow.
Bye. See you tomorrow.